So welcome everyone to our third series, third talk interview in our series. My name's Suri Gupta, and really pleased to be sitting here with you, Subhuti. Subhuti, as you know, is our president. He is the really the founder of the London Buddhist Centre. He was the first chair of the London Buddhist Centre, and he comes once or twice every year, really, and spends an intensive week with us and meeting lots of people, talking to lots of people, and really giving his sort of guidance and blessing, really, to the centre. So we're very lucky to have him there, and I've been really enjoying this time round. I always enjoy your visits and the rambles you give, and this time round we've been having these interviews, and they've been really enjoyable and very different as well. So the first day we had Subhadramati talking. The theme was, why do I suffer? And and you talked about the different levels of suffering, the different types of suffering, and how experience of suffering, sort of ordinary suffering in a way, like that sort of restless sense that we get, that sort of bored sense that we have, that there must be more, how those experiences can be quite pivotal to, well, can actually help us if we work with them creatively, dharmically, help us find the doorways to freedom. So that was a come in. Get yourself settled. There's a space here.
A bit round the back there.
So that was the still waving going on. Okay, over there. So that was day one. Yesterday, Gus interviewed you, and it was, is enlightenment possible, really possible? And in there, you spoke about how the conceptual mind cannot understand enlightenment. It confound any attempts at trying to pin it down is confounded. However, this is where I wanted to start today, really. You did say yesterday that even though you cannot sort of conceptually understand it, right at the very beginning of encountering the Dharma, you had a taste of enlightenment. And obviously over the next decades of practice, you've been basically understanding that, deepening it, having it more consistent as an experience. That was what I was, you can clarify what you meant there. But certainly I was very fascinated by this taste of enlightenment right from the very beginning. And I wanted to start there. And then our theme today, just in case you're wondering where we're going, is how can I make the world a better place, or how can I benefit the world? But let's start with this taste of enlightenment. Partly because as you were talking yesterday, I suddenly had my own similar experiences, different but similar experiences to that. And I remember one of them. Well, firstly, it was a weekend retreat where I was on, and I was so distracted all the way through the retreat, apart from the very last meditation. And suddenly I thought, my mind got very absorbed, and I just thought, oh, this is happiness. I don't actually have to look anywhere for happiness. It's here. So that was the first one. But the major one that I had, and this is why it particularly came to mind yesterday, was because it was at York Hall when they had the celebration of the death anniversary of one of Bhante's teachers, Dada Rinpoche. Oh, yeah. And I'd only been involved 2 months. And I went along, and they were doing a puja. And in the puja, they had the Heart Sutra. So if you haven't come across the Heart Sutras, it's very complex text. I had no idea what it meant. Absolutely confounded my intellectual mind. It's like a foreign language. And yet at the same time, I knew that was the truth. And I knew I had to somehow give myself to the truth. So this first taste of enlightenment, can you say more about that? And particularly, what impact did it have on you initially? What did you do with it?
Yes. Well, in a way, I could say that I've always had that taste in my mouth. I don't know how. It's only in hindsight that I realise I've always had it. But it began to become a very powerful factor in my life around the time I finished at university. I have to admit that it was to some extent chemically induced.
you missed that out.
City Ratner will know all about that. But I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody else to do that, but that sort of seemed to bring something to the fore, especially smoking weed in circumstances where one was very, very quiet. And I used to imbibe the substances. I used to inhale substances, like Mr. Clinton didn't. with, as it happened, an American from San Francisco. And he, like none of the rest of us, used to just sit in complete silence in a darkened room and smoke away. Usually we'd listen to music. But he just sat in complete silence. And I had, from that, I think more from the silence than from the substance, which merely focused me, had a very, very deep experience, which in a way I can say my taste of the Dhamma is no different now than what it was then. It's just got stronger and I'm better able to keep it in my mouth than I was before. But it seems in some ways, with hindsight, that it's sort of been there always, came really into consciousness at that time, and has just got steadier and deeper over time. What I did immediately with the next day, I went out and bought all the scriptures of all the major religions. I mentioned that the first night. And I made nothing of all of them except for the Buddhist scriptures, Gonza's Buddhist scriptures, and I think I mentioned on the first night. As soon as I heard the Buddha talking through the Gonza's translation of some Pali suttas, I knew of certainty that this was the truth. This man had experienced the truth because it was the truth that I had experienced. I became also very fascinated by the Book of the Dead, a short extract from the Book of the Dead, which is in that collection. And what really struck me in the Book of the Dead, which many of you will know, but it's an account from the Tibetan tradition of what happens after death and how you, in that after-death state, gain enlightenment if you want to, or at least get yourself as close to it as you possibly can. And the refrain behind it all the time is that whatever appears is but the projection of your own mind. And this had a very deep resonance for me. So it sort of went on from there, and fairly quickly I decided I wanted to learn to meditate in order to stabilise that experience. I didn't really clearly distinguish between one religion and another, and I tried a few different contexts, which, you know, very quickly I could tell this wasn't what I wanted. And eventually found myself in 14 Monmouth Street, in an underground basement in central London, and the rest is history.
So were there any... So I was thinking that when people go on retreats, and they sometimes have this big opening experience, but the going back home or the going back to one's life can be quite intensely challenging. So I wondered, did you have any challenges like that? You know, sort of practically, how did you work with, what did you do in terms of like following that experience? And were there any challenges in bringing, living something of it?
My goodness, how many? Do you want me to
enumerate? Give me a few.
I suppose the main thing was working out exactly what I should do. And I did go to speak to Sangharaksha Chittabhante. I think that the second or third time I went to the centre and said, you know, I've really got this, and I know this is what I must do with my life, and I'm presuming that I must go to the East and that I must find, you know, a monastery or a teacher in the East. And he simply said, well, you don't need to go to the East, and in fact that may be simply more confusing for you, and that actually we've got everything here. Actually, we didn't have anything. Just a room full of people and one Sangharakshita. That was enough. And so I just kept up contact with him and kept going to classes, and just slowly things began to unfold. Unfortunately, I was pretty free. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a career. Made my mind I wasn't going to have a family. And so I was able to move with the unfolding opportunities.
And was there anything of that experience and what happened afterwards that was about benefiting others or contributing to the world in any way?
I think from the very start, as soon as I really began to be clear that the Dhamma was the truth, I felt that it should be shared, that I should share it. Probably to some extent from a slightly naive, missionary, proselytizing aspiration, but, you know, nonetheless, a feeling that what I'd got wasn't just for me, it was for everybody. And that was a very strong flavour of our movement in the early days, a strong sense that we should share it. I think it still is, but we're very strongly motivated to spread the Dhamma. And as soon as I'd been ordained, in fact, before I was ordained, Deva Mitra and I started teaching meditation in the main centre. We were not even Mitras, because we didn't have Mitras in those days. You were never, you see it shows, doesn't it? but yes, I think for me it was always bound up with the fact that I myself could see this was what I needed to be doing. And so it seemed, I can't even say why, it just was obvious that this was what everybody should be doing. And perhaps I was a little naive in thinking that everybody was going to approach it in the same way as I did. But nonetheless, it seemed to me bound up with the taste of the Dhamma, that it wasn't just for me, it was for everybody.
Yeah. So, because I was reflecting on the fact that, you know, the first two questions we had in this in this series was, you know, why do I suffer?
Right.
So there's no person, human being on this planet who wants to suffer. I mean, it's kind of very intrinsic to our experience to do something about that.
Yeah.
And the second one, yes, what do we do about that? Mm. But I thought this third question is like, can I make the world a better place, or how do I benefit the world? How is that intrinsic to our experience? Is that intrinsic to our experience as a human being? Is that, is it intrinsic to us as being Buddhists? You know, how intrinsic is that as an experience to want to make the world a better place? Okay.
Well, I think it is intrinsic to the experience of the Dhamma. To the extent that you really experience the Dhamma, you have gone a little bit beyond your own self-attachment. So you've begun to, as it were, be more objective. I don't mean that in the rational sense, but you've begun to look beyond your own subjective interest. By definition, it's intrinsic to the experience of any degree of release from selfishness, from self-absorption, self-interest. It just goes with it. Because you then are opened up, you're no longer so rigidly attached to one pole of the dimensions of experience, the inner pole. You're beginning to be a little bit more aware of the larger field of awareness. So it seems to be simply not something you think about. Thinking will help you to ground that and to expand it, but it seems to be absolutely intrinsic to any degree of self-transcendence, because it's self-transcendence. Mm. And self-transcendence doesn't mean becoming a sort of blob. Your self-transcendence takes you into a wider connection with the world around you. And I suppose, again, I'd have to say this in retrospect, I don't think I've thought about all this very much, it just seemed obvious. But in retrospect, it seemed to me pretty obvious that if I was aware of other people's suffering, I could not be free from suffering myself entirely, because their suffering impinges upon me. Their ignorance, the false trails that they follow impinges upon me, maybe not absolutely directly, but in terms of my awareness, in terms of my consciousness. And as I said on the first night, I've had a very lucky life. I was born into a privileged caste and suffered very little indeed in any of the obvious ways. Of course, I thought I was suffering horribly. It was just my mum was a bit much. But apart from that, it was pretty easy. And all, you know, I've said every door I came up to just opened as I came up to it. Without any effort or struggle on my part. I assumed that that was true for everybody else, just because they weren't making enough effort. But I began to realise it. Don't look at me. There's a glimpse of... I began to realise it wasn't quite like that, and to encounter people who clearly that had not been their experience of life. But, you know, I moved within a privileged caste until a certain point in my life, when I began to reject that, that, you know, class identity, and consciously try to move beyond that for all sorts of obscure reasons. But, yeah, then I began to realise that other people really were not just lazy or stupid or ignorant or whatever.
Might come back to that okay. conditioning and the way you've worked with that, because I think it's quite interesting. In terms of we're just sort of laying the ground here, I think, because I think, so what you've sort of identified for you as intrinsic to the experience that you had, and you and particularly recognising other people's suffering, and that you knew there was a way, you know, you knew there was a way, and for you to share that with others felt natural, felt obvious to you. Your understanding of how you, because I was thinking about the question about, well, what do we mean by benefiting others or benefiting the world? Because someone's way of benefiting the others can actually be cause suffering. Were you at the time, or how were you at the time sort of distinguishing, well, this is of true benefit and this isn't? How did you understand what real benefit was?
Well, I just thought the Dhamma was the true benefit. And I realised that it took quite a while for me to realise that, really mainly when I went to India, that many people were not in a position to really practice the Dhamma because of their social circumstances and the cultural environment within which they lived. You know, Dalits in India, and it's the same for the Gypsies in Hungary that I'm connected with. It's ridiculous to ask them to meditate straight off. It's not fair, because they haven't got the circumstances to be allowed to be fully responsible for themselves. Social circumstances deprive them of that responsibility. You can't really practice the Dhamma unless you're fully responsible for yourself. Some do remarkably well, but for many it's just not possible. So I suppose it's all a bit unthinking. Do you know what I mean? I didn't really think about all this. It just unfolded itself. So to begin with, I'd have just thought everybody needs the Dhamma. They should all come to the LBC and learn meditation. Bus. That's it. And if they don't, it's their own silly fault. I did begin to realise that you needed to try to attract them and to make it easy for them to come. But I think I've realised more recently we need to make even more effort than we do now, even in Britain, that we need to reach all the time beyond the settled circle that we naturally attract around us. So, to begin with, it was simply thinking that the Dhamma was for everybody, and it is for everybody, but that it was for everybody in the way that it was for me. I think I've become a little bit more sophisticated because I've been extremely fortunate to find myself working with people who really are very, very much deprived of even the basic ground for practicing the Dhamma. I've come to appreciate that just becoming a full human being and claiming your human dignity is a huge step in the direction of the Dhamma. It is the Dhamma in a certain sense, but that one cannot reject people because they don't meditate. Like sometimes I take people with me to our work in Hungary. It's not my work, but I support our mitras there. And they always want to teach people to meditate. And I've tried teaching a bunch of young gypsies to meditate, and it's extremely embarrassing because they just giggle all the time and make remarks about me behind my back, which fortunately I can't understand because I don't speak Hungarian. But fair enough, I would be doing that if I came from their background. So it's ridiculous. That's not the place to start. It has to start somewhere else. So I think that I've become more sophisticated in my understanding that the principles of the Dhamma apply to everybody, but those principles have to be translated into the next step for the person you're dealing with. Do you see what I mean? I'm not fitted to do that for everybody because my own experience is not wide enough, and I'm not particularly broadly versatile in that sort of way. Some people are much, much better than me in that kind of way. But one needs to understand that the Dhamma is for everybody, but it's not for everybody in the in the same way. And especially for people who are more marginalised, and there are a lot of them in this world, a hell of a lot of them in this world, that the first step is by claiming personal responsibility and accepting themselves as true human beings, mm-hmm. as equal human beings, as human beings. So that I see as the Dhamma.
So in India, how did that sort of, what actually happened? Because you've been really involved there. You sound like it really changed your perception about what benefit in the world or benefiting is.
Yeah.
What actually happened in terms of the difference between here and there?
I should say that I owe my friends in India a great debt because they've taught me to understand my own conditioning, if you see what I mean, because I was facing people who had such a different background, so different. Like when I first went to India, for several years, I'd feel really lonely because I didn't know how to connect with people. You know, for me, that seemed as if they were very superficial. I've now come to understand that it was me that was very superficial. It taught me to see how much I'm reliant on, a relatively privileged, not greatly privileged, but basically privileged middle class background and parents who were always successful in the world and, going to expensive public schools where I got cold showers and bad food. My parents made a lot of money for that, but a very good education. A sort of sense of my own potential, my own possibility. And it came to see that that's not the experience of everybody. It seems so obvious, doesn't it, now? But it wasn't obvious then. Of course, it wasn't completely not obvious, but to a large extent. So I learned a great deal from that. But then in India, because of Dr. Ambedkar, people have a deep, deep feeling for the Dhamma, a very strong feeling for the Dhamma, because for them, through Dr. Ambedkar, it has been the means of claiming their humanity. Dr. Ambedkar, Baba Saheb, I can't stop calling him Baba Saheb, which is the name that they call him, a loving honorific, if you see what I mean, a very lovely term. It means something like grandfather, grandfather sir. They absolutely love Dr. Ambedkar. Sometimes people feel they worship him in an unhealthy way. I don't feel that. He was a leader worthy of their trust. He said, our fight is a fight for human dignity. And he saw the Dhamma as the basis for human dignity. And he saw then further that the Dhamma was the basis for a free and just society. So I've gone there to try to support my brothers and sisters in India who are followers of Dr. Ambedkar. Of course, we try to reach beyond that community, but it's still quite difficult because of the caste barriers to mix people from different backgrounds. And of course, that's one of the functions that somebody from outside that system can perform. But then it's very difficult to integrate, so you end up with a sort of apartheid movement. Mm. There's a great danger in Hungary too. You end up with two different movements, which I really don't want. It's a denial of Sangha. So yes, I support them in their struggle. And especially what I've been focusing on, I'm going to focus on much more, is offering them much more depth in Dhamma experience. They can better do the social and political message because they come from that society and they understand what they're doing. I've been going to India for 30 years and I still don't really understand. And I still make horrible solecisms, many of which I don't even know. They're so tolerant and so hospitable that nobody will ever tell you that, will they? They just let you make a silly ass of yourself in a kindly sort of way, not out of showing you up. But yes, it's up to them really to do the work of communicating with their brothers and sisters. I can help them a bit in communicating to people from a caste background that's more like mine. The large Indian middle class, which is usually upper caste. Caste and class are not the same, but caste often does coincide, upper caste, so-called, does often coincide with middle class. Not altogether. And of course, there's now a large Buddhist middle class. But I can help a bit there. But as people have got deeper and deeper into the Dhamma, they feel the need for a stronger experience of the Dhamma as individuals, not as a social and psychological and political program, which is completely legitimate and we need to continue. But I can give them, help them to get that greater depth in meditation, in study of the Dhamma, which they're not yet, well, they're getting near there, they're not yet able to produce for themselves. Mm. Not to the depth that I can bring it. Not long, I'm going to be redundant soon. Mm-hmm. But yes, so I've tried to see what I can do. If they want me always to make public talks and so forth, because that I have prestige, if you see what I mean. So people will come because I'm there, a white man. And
I was going to say, what's the basis of that prestige?
Is it? Well, it's completely empty, but it's the fact that I'm white and I'm a foreigner. It's probably the same if you're black and a foreigner, probably more if you're white and a foreigner, and probably if you're a white male and a foreigner. But, you know, one has to sort of sometimes take advantage of completely accidental advantages. So they want me to do that, but I feel more and more that actually I shouldn't do that, that they should take the forward position. And they are, they're able to. Mm. There's some, you know, there's order members in India, leading order members are in India, who's as good as any anywhere. Mm. And as dedicated and with as good a grasp of the Dhamma as any. And I've played my small part in bringing that about.
Mm. Gosh, so basically, I mean, you're one of the few order members, if the main order member actually, who have had this intensive connection with India and seen it grow through those years. There's a few, but there's...
Of course, there's Loka Mitra, who's been their resident all that time.
And you've also been very deeply immersed here. So can you say something about the difference you see between the ways we practice? Because what you've described there is this sort of a way of practicing that really is able to reach out to people who wouldn't ordinarily, you know, study the Dhamma. Yeah. What do you, how are we different here?
Yeah. Well, caricaturing wildly, you could say that in India, people, the problem in India, or rather the tendency in India, the extreme to which they go, is to be only concerned with social and political questions. Mm-hmm. They're just concerned with getting out of caste. At their worst, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's the pole that they tend to be most concerned with. What are we doing about this atrocity, that atrocity, the fact that, you know, a huge Hindu mob attacked a big Buddhist celebration and several people were killed. Mm-hmm. What are we doing about that? So they'll tend to go that way. Mm-hmm. Here, people tend to be concerned about themselves and their own struggles and their own personal difficulties. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, now straddle both, so I'm in the perfect position. yes, I think here we're still too self-absorbed, and in India, still people do not, still not enough people fully realise that social and political change rest upon a much deeper change.
Right. Okay.
So I think, you know, caricaturing wildly, and different people have different experiences and so on, but that would be the general picture. Mm-hmm. And my Indian friends, when they come over, are really struck by it.
Mm.
It really stands out for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of Bhante's geniuses that he's created a movement which unites two such different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he saw that as educative, because in being in contact with the other culture, you have to round out.
Mm.
So Indians tend to, through their coming here, tend, if you like, to become more individual, because in a highly structured society, very, very strong family structure and traditional structure, and with a caste which makes, you know, you've got a large family which you have an intense loyalty to, and which is opposed to other castes. Not as simple as that, but again, caricaturing wildly. It's very difficult to experience yourself separate.
Mm.
So you experience yourself as, you know, part of that caste, that community, that family, and difficult to step beyond that. There are plenty who now do.
Mm.
And then in the West, it's easy for us not to realise that we are part of a larger whole, we're part of a society, we're part of a human family, if you like, and that our own happiness and freedom rest inextricably upon attending to that.
So, because when you're saying that, I'm like, I sort of completely resonate with that. And I also know the experience that people often have, when, particularly when you're faced with how do I benefit the world or how can I contribute, is one of, can be, there's different experiences, different emotional responses to it.
Yeah.
And one of them can be, you know, I've got enough, I've got to sort out my own. Those first two questions, my own suffering, and how do I free myself from it? How do I even just survive and get through my everyday?
Yeah.
That's often what stops people from even thinking they can make a contribution.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I would say that that to a degree is fair enough. I think it if you start trying to benefit others in one way or another when you're not sufficiently sorted out yourself, what you do is you project your problems onto other people. And I read somewhere quite recently that there's a known phenomenon that many political active, social activists in the West, a study was done in England, a study was done, suffer from depression. So it's a way of as it were, dealing with your own inner disquiet it by trying to sort things outside you. You know, jolly good, at least you're doing something, but you'd be able to do it much better if you worked things out a bit more in yourself. So I'm not, I don't deny that. In a way, you could say it's the equal and opposite of Dalits in India or Roma in Hungary needing to get just a basic human dignity. So it's the obverse.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? That, but then it has to begin to broaden out. And anybody who does begin to get beyond the basic stage of human dignity or, you know, reasonable psychological health and social health, will naturally begin to expand into the other sphere. So I've seen it with my Dalit friends and my Roma friends too, that at a certain point they begin to want to work much more on themselves because they realise the limitations of what they do for others because of their own lack of sorted outness, not at the very basic level, but at a higher level.
Yeah.
So, for instance, Janos, who's the leading Gypsy Roma Dhamma Mitra in Hungary, he said that when he encountered the Metta Bhavana, it just completely changed his whole social activist perspective, and it stopped being one of, you know, hatred for Hungarians, which means white people. It became something much more broad. He's still mainly concerned to get, you know, gypsies who are completely marginalised. By the way, they prefer to be called gypsies, but Tsigani, but because Roma has the connotation of a particular set who speak the Romani language. So I sometimes, it's better to speak of Roma because that's more commonly understood to be correct term, but I will slip occasionally. But yes, many Roma are strongly anti-Hungarians, and you can completely understand why. Vice versa, of course. You can even understand to some extent why that happens too. But, you know, as somebody like Janos realises that that's not enough, he's got to look at the whole of society, although his main focus is on Roma.
Right, yeah. So those two poles of experience are sort of like, well, I need to sort myself out.
Yeah.
And the other one of kind of, well, I need to respond to the world, but then coming from a deeper base. Is that a sort of natural tension of practicing more and more deeply,
yes.
sort of going from one to the other? And
oh, yeah. And I think that probably everybody will experience that tension and work it out in different ways. You know, I tend to work extremely hard. I like to do that. It's not because I have to. I like to do that. Engage myself very fully in the work of you know, doing what I can to benefit others. I like then to engage pretty intensively in meditation and study in solitude. So I try to oscillate between the two. That works best for me, but others may need to do it in a more balanced, day by day balanced way. Yeah, but the two will need to be represented and will be represented and will be in something of tension. I've been mentioning that until 3 weeks ago, I was on solitary retreat. I'd been on solitary retreat for 6 months. fairly soon after I started my retreat, after I'd done a bit of basic sorting out of, you know, karma, I found myself faced with the sort of thought, well, you know, what am I doing? There I was reasonably happy, I was enjoying myself. Well, you know, what's this got to do with anything? What's this got to do with the price of beans? How does this affect anybody else? And I had to bring that into my solitude, that in my solitude I was trying to do something in my own experience that I could then, that would bring me into a deeper connection with other people, which hopefully would benefit them.
Because you say it's natural and intrinsic, this kind of, as you go deeper, there's a...
Yeah.
And Buddhism and can have a reputation of being sort of separate from the world, isolated from the world. So is it also a sort of risk or danger, if you like, that we do get absorbed, reabsorbed back into sort of some kind of sense of self and not make that connection with the world?
Yeah. Well, I think the dangers lie on both sides. The danger is that, you know, you become a social activist or whatever, and you do what may be good work, but you never really attend to the inner issues. And I think that's a strong temptation, which I see more commonly amongst Buddhists in India.
Yeah.
But not only. Whereas, you know, more commonly one sees here, people just become absorbed in their own practice, and you even get... there's a bit of a phase at the moment of insight talk and enlightenment talk in a way that I find a little disturbing, because it seems so much like my possession, my insight, my enlightenment, where it seems to me insight and enlightenment are the very denial of the personal character of these things. So I think that the natural tendency, it's not just the natural tendency from a Buddhist point of view, it's the natural tension from a Buddhist point of view, it's a tension within life itself. If you see what I mean, the tension between self and other, which is just intrinsic to opening your eyes, because there's an inner, some schools of Buddhism, they talk about an inner perceiving dimension and an outward perceived dimension. And other people belong in the outer perceived dimension, but they're odd because they also have their own inner perceiving dimension. Sorry if that's not getting too elliptical, but... So it's intrinsic just to opening your eyes. There are all of you. Here is me. And I cannot, fortunately or unfortunately, I can't just close you all off. And I can't just close myself off. So I can't resolve the tension on its own level. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The tension has to be resolved on a level where these distinctions are only relative within a larger, as it were, absolute field of awareness.
Okay, so...
Don't ask me what that means.
let's go back to where we were, this sort of tension between, the risk of... potentially sort of getting more and more absorbed in your practice and somehow actually not making that transition to connecting with others.
Right.
And you're now talking about what actually goes on in the mind, or the structure of the mind,
that's
what contributes to that tension.
Yes, Yes, it's inbuilt. It's, in Buddhist terms, it's sahaja. It's born with us. This absolutely intrinsic distinction between self and other. We're attached to a self in here, and we're relating to an other out there. Mm. And so there's a natural tension between the two. We want the other to conform to self's interest.
Right.
And at the same time, we often find that we're dancing to the tune of other.
Mm.
So... we have to find a way to resolve that tension, and exists for everybody, Buddhist or not, as with everything that Buddhism deals with. Buddhism isn't a special department of human experience. It's a way of approaching human experience which helps to resolve it.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of this question of how I benefit or help others, how does that then, that tension, self and other, play out there? What I was wanting to find out was how do we actually work with this risk, because you talked about your solitary retreat and how you had to consciously bring some other dimension into the retreat to bridge that gap between yourself and other.
Yeah.
So how do we, what do we do to kind of bring that into mind if it is a tension that we can just be reabsorbed into ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, or go out to other in a way that forgets ourselves.
Yeah.
Forgets our, you know, that doesn't have the depth to it.
Yes, of course, to some extent, which pole one is more likely to fall into, can you fall into a pole, get attached to, it depends on many circumstances. It depends on character, it depends on genetics, it depends on culture, and so forth. It depends on the opportunities of life. You know, middle class existence often tends to self-absorption, self-interest, not always, but because often the greatest philanthropists are from the middle classes, but your culture to some extent determines that, and the extent to which you've lived as part of a community. You know, like if you come from a family which is a very warm and like you do, which is very, very close, then you're naturally relating to the world around you in that sort of way. So all of those factors are there. But then when it comes to practicing Buddhism, there's a question of views, of understanding. So what Buddhism does is it gives us ways of looking at the experience which is just given to us in by virtue of being conscious. It gives us ways of looking at that and unfolding it. And if you have a way of looking at it that it puts all the focus simply on the inner dimension, that will tend to reinforce your own self-attachment. And some, especially Western Buddhists, do that. It's a tendency within Western Buddhism, because Western Buddhism, by and large, comes out of the sort of therapeutic sort of approach, solving the problem of me. The set and setting, that the ideas. Ideas are so important. They're far more important than we realise. And they do structure experience. They direct you into your experience in a certain way. And equally, you can have, within some schools of Buddhism, or rather within some areas of Buddhism, which I see more commonly in India, but elsewhere too in the East, you see a doctrine, set of views that privilege the outer work. And you can tell it's not quite right, because a person seems a bit unsorted, if you see what I mean. I think it's very important that we, in developing our Sangha, have a way of understanding the practice that we do that is equivalent, that it points in both directions, and that allows people to move, you know, in terms of their own needs, as it were, between addressing those poles, but which does very much keep both areas of work alive. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, to be topical, I think a centre like this needs, you know, to have its meditation classes, its mitra study, its Dhamma talks and so forth. It needs to have those, you know, to an even greater degree. But I think it also needs to have some other aspect that reaches beyond, not just by attracting people to the centre. I think one of those ways that reaches beyond is by trying to get to people who could benefit from the Dhamma, but who wouldn't step through the doors of a centre like this. We know all about that, don't we? I think that there needs to be that consciousness. How do we get more people to come in here who would not come here otherwise? Mm-hmm. How do we make sure they feel comfortable? I think, you know, black people often didn't feel comfortable because it's just a bunch of middle-class white boys. Mm-hmm. They need the Dhamma too, but you need to make sure it actually is expressing an openness. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is good for you because it means you are becoming more open. But I'd like to suggest that we need to do something a bit wider than that. Of course, my pet project is my dear Roma friends who struggle so much and have so little support. I'd love to see a centre like this with an active role in that. And, you know, some order members do come with me. But you could imagine if a centre like this had a project like that, that, you know, had it in, the good thing about this is it's definitely, the, for instance, the school they run is a Buddhist school. Mm. And it's the Dr. Ambedkar High School, it's called. So, you know, choosing a project that you can still connect it with your Buddhist aspirations, but it's definitely stepping outside the usual sphere. Of course, you can do beneficial work in all sorts of ways. Yeah. You can be a doctor or a social worker or whatever, or collect food for a food bank, or all of that is great. But I think a centre almost needs to have that dimension very much alive within it. Mm. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn to the
chairman. No, well, it's interesting about how you go about choosing. So there's a few things about how we individually have an impact on the world. Coming from a Dharmic perspective, or using our practice to kind of, you know, have that positive effect, and then how we collectively as a sangha have an influence. Both seem important.
Yes.
I was just thinking about some of the topical issues of the day.
Right.
You know, climate change is big at the moment. You mentioned diversity. There's lots of issues: poverty, violence in London. I just wondered how, in terms of us sort of responding to those things, whether we do that individually or collectively, what do we need to be bearing in mind about how we go about it? Because you mentioned views.
Sure. Yeah.
And I just wanted to touch back on that a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that I think if we can do it collectively, we'll be much better at it. We'll be much more effective. What we will take to people is not just, you know, some food, but we'll bring them a touch of sangha.
Mm. Right.
But yes, I think that all the current issues which concern people all have some basis. You know, there is a real problem that needs dealing with. But very often the ideas that surround the action that's taking place in relation to those are not ones that I can feel comfortable with. I'm not sure that I dare mention anything, but I think it does. Well, let's take climate change. I think it's not a good thing to address climate change on the basis of anxiety and pressure. I think we have to have a positive approach, which may address what the anxiety is about, but I think it needs to be done on a highly positive basis. So we need to, for instance, take any of these issues and try to get to the Dhammic heart of it. Mm. What is the issue behind, from the Dhammic point of view, behind the problems of, I think it's more than climate change, it's environmental degradation in general. That's the real issue, and which climate change is only part of. So what is the issue from a Buddhist point of view? And as we were discussing the other day, for me, it seems that the issue is that we are not sufficiently aware of the world around us, of the natural world around us, as alive. We experience the natural world around us, and this is part of our materialist inheritance. We think of it as a machine that, well, what was it? Early Renaissance poet, a pope, declared that that the world existed for the benefit of humanity, and you know, so that it was for humanity to exploit the world for their benefit. Mm. But that's not a very good way of looking at it, because it'll backfire. Whereas, in contrast, the Tibetans will not cut the soil without very careful preparation. They consider that the earth is alive. They consider that there's spirit everywhere. If you see what I mean, they will be careful about cutting trees. I've seen Tibetans at Bodh Gaya at night when the lights are lit. Lots and lots of insects come, and you see them walking through the insects. They won't just walk over them. And so they have it's not something they're telling themselves, it's something they feel, that the world around them is alive. Of course, they conceive of that in animist terms, that there are spirits everywhere. But they're not exactly wrong, it just doesn't quite suit our way of looking at it. But actually, the world is alive, and trees are alive. But we conceive of it as being for our purpose, and then we exploit it, and we're astonished and surprised when it starts to backfire on us, and then we start to make a fuss about it without often, not everybody, without addressing the fundamental issue of our relationship to life, life in its most, a form that's furthest from our human consciousness, but for which we should feel something like metta at that level. And I think that if as Buddhists, we may wish to address the specific issues of climate change, but I think we should be doing it on the basis of a sense of the world as alive, and we should be encouraging that kind of consciousness in others. Mm. What you actually do to do that, it's not my department. I've got other work to do. I'll leave that to you. But I'm not being flippant. It's just that you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. But I think that those who are concerned about these issues need to try to go back to Buddhist basics. Mm. What does it mean to be a Buddhist in relation to the natural world? And what would the Buddha feel? You know, the famous question, what would Jesus do? What would the Buddha feel in relation to this? And, well, we know what the Buddha felt, because in the scriptures, the Buddha lives in an extremely positive relationship with the natural world around him. For instance, the monks, nuns, when they went into the three-month rainy season retreat, one of the reasons for them to go into the rainy season retreat was because if they were walking around in the rainy season, there's so many animals and you tread on them. And I know, I've been to India in the rainy season, and you do, you can't avoid it. So the part of the reason for that was reverence for life. The Buddha very notably gained enlightenment under a tree. And you know what happened immediately after his enlightenment? He spent 1 week gazing at the tree, just standing, looking at the tree. And what one's supposed to understand from that? In gratitude, in reverence to it, that it had sheltered him. And the rest of the time he was at Bodh Gaya, he sat under different trees. So there are many, many examples of that, like that. And the Buddha, of course, moved in an animist world, which he seemed to experience in that way. And he experienced spirits and, you know, dryads and naiads and all the same sort of things you get in Greek mythology. He experienced them, and he had a positive interaction with them, taught them the Dhamma. So we can't start talking like that in this context, because it just sounds like the pathetic fallacy. It just sounds like a fantasy. But there's something within that which is the sense of the world as alive, and the sense of trees and animals and rocks as having some sort of life, as manifesting life on their level that we manifest on ours. Mm. And, you know, when you're in something of a more self-released state, you feel that. Mm. You feel the life in the world around you.
Sort of response around climate change and environmental degradation, about actually where some of the sort of Buddhist views would come into us and actually really change the way we then communicate about it. Because I think the one thing about, you know, many of the causes, whatever it is, it arouses strong emotion because
anger.
It's suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
So it arouses strong emotion and then we then respond from that basis.
Yes. Yeah.
So how do we actually cultivate a dharmic basis for responding?
Yeah. Well, I think the fundamental thing is metta.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fundamental. And I often tell a story of teaching metta bhavna in Haryana, which is a very backward state, not so far from Delhi, where there's extreme casteism. Casteism means active discrimination and atrocity of an appalling kind, most of which doesn't even reach press, doesn't reach the police. So I was asked to meet with a group of Dalit Buddhists, and they actually did want me to teach meditation. So I came to teach Metta Bhavna, and I introduced the practice. When I got to the enemy stage, I could see that they weren't buying it. They were not buying it. And eventually somebody piped up, "I'm not going to feel metta for those upper castes. You know, I'm not going to love what they've done to us. Are you asking me to thank them for what they've done to us?" And I, you know, in my very English, reasonable sort of way, tried to explain it, and I could see I was just getting nowhere, and it was getting worse. My translator, who was very patiently translating my words, eventually got fed up, and he just burst out. He just suddenly burst out, Maitri Majbute, Majbute! And Majbut means strong, it's strength. And, okay, you just carry on. I'm too sort of... anyway, and of course I just went, oh, yeah, great, yeah, fine, yeah, that's fine. And you know, because if you feel Maitri, you're objective, you can deal with the situation, you know how to respond. You're not going to make things worse, you're not going to just go in opposition. You're going to sort of skillfully work your way through it. And I think that's the message. Our metta needs to be brought into these situations of conflict and difficulty or problem, and we need to work out our strategy in relation to metta. And we need to be careful that what we do promotes positive mental states and the kind of mental states will bring about a real change. Which doesn't mean you don't address the issue, but you address it from a point of view of metta and of everybody presumably knows what metta means, loving kindness, and you try to make sure that, well, as much as you can, you're working with people on that basis, and I think you're much more likely to succeed. In the short run, of course, strength of feeling and even hot feeling is very powerful. There's a very, very good talk by Dr. Ambedkar, which was the last talk he gave, just about a month before he died. He was asked to address the World Fellowship of Buddhists conference in Kathmandu. And of course, he just converted to Buddhism, so he was a real hero. And he was bringing, you know, so many, by then, millions of people into Buddhism for the first time. So they really wanted to hear what he had to say. So he gave one talk, which is about the conversion. Then they asked him to give another one. And they asked him to address the question of the Buddha or Karl Marx. Because at that time, it was 1950s, that was the direction that many marginalised people would turn. They'd turn to communism, to violent revolution, as a means of resolving their suffering. And one can completely sympathise. So he explored the differences between the Buddha's perspective and Karl Marx's perspective. He applauded Marx and communism's aim. He said he shared that aim, but he'd come to, and to begin with, he did work with communists in Bombay in union work, but he came to diverge from them as to means. And he says, you know, our means of changing is to invite people or give people the occasion voluntarily to change. We know that a change that is forced will not abide, and it'll turn simply into its obverse, and that the class or caste or whatever it is that was previously deprived will then become the oppressor, as we see in many situations in the world, in all the ironies of Israel and Palestine, for instance. To cut through in a very caricatured way. But so he said, well, the only real change is a change on the basis of the Dhamma, on ethical principles and in a positive way, which leaves the other person free. Mm-hmm. And then the change will be a lasting change. Then at the end, he said, people will say this is a tedious way, a long way. And he said, it will be, it may be. But I am certain that it is the sure way, and that in the long run, this will work. And that is my credo.
Yes.
That's my political credo, if you like. Mm. I want to see a change that is deep and that is deeply rooted in the experience of the individual, and that is based upon the most positive of principles and the principle of human growth and ultimate perfectibility. I think Dr. Ambedkar is a very, very important source of inspiration for us and of guidance too, in this respect. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sabuti, and those really rousing words to... We're
was
7
that
o'clock.
The end? Yeah. Oh, no.
I was just getting going. So rousing words to end. And you've also, within this, you've also given us some, as a collective, some things to be thinking about as well. So I really want to thank you very much. Really just for giving yourself. I love that you've said this is what you stand by. This is, you know, because I think in a way you demonstrate that through your work. You go to very, I mean, Hungary is a very challenging place for to anyone
for
to go
them.
To. And, you know, you're putting yourself actually in challenging situations now to actually have an effect. And then to your sort of... sort of intelligently and sensitively working out what that effect is and having to adapt along the way as well. And I remember you telling me once it was sometimes quite humiliating, you know, you being there. And I feel that that shows a lot for the fact that you're growing through this process, you're changing, and you're actually inspiring many of us in that way to follow on as well. So I want to thank you for the example that you set, the challenge that you give us, and the guidance as well, the Dharmic guidance as to how to make whatever we do long-lasting and truly effective.
Can I put in one little thing that I wanted to go into?
Go ahead.
I'm not going to explore it very fully, but I just want to say it. I think it's very important that you don't think that you're just benefiting other people. Do you see what I mean? I think if you go in with that in mind... is going to backfire. And you need to have it be aware that you're actually bringing about a human interchange in which you will gain greatly.
Which is also what you were sort of saying that about yourself, about how indebted you are to people in India, because they've actually helped you change. And we didn't explore fully like that in detail, but that's work that we can do. So I want to thank you. If you want to hear more of Sabuti, he's going to be here on Saturday with the Transforming Self and World Group. And we're going to be going into some of this, I imagine. I don't
you
know what
bet
actually.
Your life we are.
In much more detail as well. So do come along to that. And you'll be around the rest of the week hanging out and meeting up with people. And so I want to thank you for giving of yourself. And actually, we want to give you something. And I also want to encourage you, if you feel inspired, actually, I hope you do, and sort of invigorated by this series of conversations, we want to help Sabuti continue doing this work. It's very important that you do this work. Very few people, in fact, no one I know, is doing this kind of work, going to India, Hungary, coming back here, travelling around Srivatna, travelling, connecting with other Buddhists. We want to help you continue that work. I'd like to invite you to help Sabuti continue that work. And he gives himself freely. And I'd like you to help continue his work by, you know, contributing to the Dana bowl on your way out. It really does make a difference to you, Sabuti, to be able to travel and teach and just be available from this source of wisdom that you've been cultivating and kindness, actually, over the years. So let's give Sabuti something from ourselves first. And thank you. So yes, we've got another class starting soon, but please, as I said, you know, help yourself to the Dana bowl. Well, not help yourself, give to the Dana bowl. Give to the Dana bowl and tap to donate. Oh, what is it?
Wow.
Oh.
Gosh, I'm
that's going to be appearing in a talk or so, isn't it?
That's enough suffering there.
And if you want to help, do we have to clear up the space or we leave it? Oh, we leave this space as it is, So thank you very much for coming. I've really appreciated your presence here, and I'll see you around as well. Thank you.
Thank you.